Our guest today studied economics at the University of Amsterdam and completed his MBA at Harvard Business School in 1968. Subsequently, he also did his PhD studies there. After a short period as assistant professor at the INSEAD Business School in France, he followed the call of the legendary Henry Mintzberg to McGill University in Montreal in 1975. In parallel, and this really fascinates us, he did psychoanalytic training at the Canadian Psychoanalytic Institute. In 1984, he returned to Europe to a chair in leadership development at the INSEAD Business School. There, he has been distinguished clinical professor of leadership development and organizational change since 1985. He has received numerous awards for his work, such as the German Lifetime Achievement Award for contributions to executive education. The German Manager magazine published an article about his work last year, the title, Analyst of the Manager Soul.
For more than 4 years, we are on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? And how can one succeed in living a purposeful, happy, healthy, productive, and fulfilling life, even in such difficult times? We are looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools, and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You are at On the Way to New Work, today with Manfred Ketz de Vries.
Hello, Manfred. How are you?
I already talked about that. How are you is a very ritualistic thing. I ask now, when people ask me, how are you, is that on a scale of 1 to 10, how good for you, 10 being the highest, 1 being the lowest, how good do you feel? Which is actually a reaction to my first visit to America, when people ask me, how are you? And I said, I don't feel so good today. I mean, I'm a little depressed. And then they looked at me like they were struck by lightning, because I should have said fine. And so they tried to get out of that situation. So I'm very wary about how are you. But as I always say, I mean, as you mentioned, I have two hats. One hat is the hat of a management professor. The other one, the hat of a psychoanalyst. And I would say everybody is normal until you know them better. So what people say is not necessarily what's all about. They, like I ask in my class, I run once a year in what I call, it's a long program, a CEO recycling seminar, in which I take 21 senior executives. And I ask them, why are you here? And so they tell me they want to be a better leader. They have some problems with their boss. I mean, they have, you know, they're trying in the middle of a merger and whatever it might be. But that's not the real reason after a while. It's like one of those Russian dolls. And you take one out and you have another one. Actually, I have at home a Russian doll with 30 layers. I mean, that's a real big one. Yeah, they're rare. They're very rare. I found it once in Moscow. Anyhow, that's a long answer to your question.
I like the way you answered this question. And I have an even better one for this start. How did you become the person you are today?
You know, that's another one of those interesting questions. I sometimes ask my students, if you make a documentary of your life, what are some of the critical moments? Mm. And of course, I mean, you know, why people have a certain career, why they do what they do. I spent a lot of energy in that. And of course, as a psychoanalyst, I have a very much a developmental orientation, which means as they do with the influence of your people close to you, which is usually parents, grandparents, brothers, sisters, and whatever. I think it was an important factor was actually going to the States after I did my doctor in economics in Holland. And it was a very, at that time, not many people did that. That was many years ago. And it was quite an interesting experience, the cross-cultural experience. And I remember I went to the Harvard Business School, and they had a special program which still exists, but not at the Harvard Business School, the International Teachers Program. And I took the traditional courses, which had to do with, you know, international economics, strategy, whatever. And then this advisor that was there said, this is a funny course given by a psychoanalyst called Psychoanalytic Psychology and Management Theory. And so there I was, you're normally reading textbook of economics, and suddenly had to read Freud's case studies, the psychotic Dr. Schreber, the Wolfman, the Redman, and that was very different. Quite exciting, particularly when you're a confused young man and trying to figure out what you really want to do in life. Anyhow, that's again a long answer to a fairly, actually that was a more complicated question.
Yeah, but it's okay. But you then found your way back to Europe. Why did you leave the States again?
No, when I was at Harvard, I was actually involved in a stress study. I was, at the time, there was a fight going on between two groups at the organizational behavior department. One was more structural oriented, which had basically the power, and one was more clinically oriented, which was a man called Selesnik. And I'm not a very good politician, so I took the clinical oriented person. And when I wanted to have a normal appointment at Harvard, that was not the right thing to do, because academics actually are masters in character assassination. I remember that at the time the head department says that I would never write anything. You know, that was, maybe that was a fantastic motivation, because I've written now, I think, 53 books. But I would never write anything. So that was his argument not to take me, while I had actually the highest teaching ratings of the whole school. And Harvard Business School is a teaching school. Anyhow, fortunately, Henry Mintzberg, as you mentioned, came to the rescue. And he had just finished the Nature of Managerial Work, which basically had studied a number of executives, what they really do. And I was in competition to get an appointment with a person who was into monkey behavior. So, I mean, he must have been, it felt, you know, from human beings' time that we also have a specialist on monkey behavior. But somehow stress won out. I was involved in a very large stress study with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So, and it was a very good time, because it was also offered me the opportunity to combine, to be involved in the Department of Psychiatry at McGill. And of course, I was trying to be a good teacher, whatever it might be, a better teacher. So the combination worked very well. But, there's a song in Quebec, Mon pays, c'est l'hiver. My country, it's the winter. And it's white, 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 white for a long, long, long time. My wife,
snow depression.
Yeah, my wife comes from Sweden, and she has seen a lot of white there too. And of course, I like Quebec. I like Canada. No question about it. I think it's a very civilized country. But there is something to say about the diversity of Europe. So when I left after, actually, this is a little bit of an, but when I left Harvard as a doctor, when I finished my doctorate, I went first to INSEAD, and I was there 2 years. And I'm Dutch, and Dutch are not very subtle about things. You know, actually, in some of my classes, sometimes they say, let's talk Dutch now. So I was not very subtle, and they fired me on the wrong reason. So the INSEAD should be very, you know, they should be very grateful to me now, because of me, they have a faculty evaluation committee, so you cannot be fired just like that. At the time, the power was concentrated in a few people. So, but maybe this is the best thing that happened to me. But I came, but they wanted me back. Actually, the next year, they wanted me back already. But I gave them the finger, and so I stayed for a long time. That's really what I did. I stayed for, very nice of them to ask me back the next year, but I mean, so I stayed for a long time in North America, and so I came back as a full professor at the time to INSEAD, and they have been very good to me, actually. It's a place which has no national identity. As you know, it has four campuses, one in, of course, the big one in Fontainebleau, and the other big one actually in Singapore, and then one in Abu Dhabi, now in San Francisco. And so it has been a very good learning experience. And they let me be. At one point in time, they bombarded me to set up a global leadership center. And I also, for them, I put in a fairly successful program, which was called Master Degree Program, Consulting and Coaching for Change, and now called the Executive Masters in Change, which has been quite profitable. It's an it's a program which is an executive program, so not people don't come for a certain period and come back to work. So that's right. In that respect, I put my stamp a little bit on the school, and particularly in the form of coaching, because when I was there, nobody talked about leadership or coaching. Now, every program in the school has a coaching element, which I think there's no school in the world which has so much coaching as INSEAD. And I mean, not just talk about MBA programs, which was actually later, because it's so expensive. There's 1,000 MBAs and coaching is not a mass production, but in all executive programs. And we are the second largest in the world after Harvard in executive programs. My little PR statement for INSEAD, I think.
That's absolutely fine.
Just as a little quick side question on this journey before Michael dives back into it, because you just mentioned it, managing conflicts, giving other people the finger from time to time and saying, okay, that's it. You fired me. I'm gone. Leadership and conflict. What would be your take on that from your personal experience? Because it seems like a very formative moment afterwards, but maybe it was different in the moment.
I mean, leadership is partially the management of conflict. It comes down to that. I mean, but I want to, when I think about what I try to do, when you think about 85% of executives, when you look at Gallup poll, is non-engaged, which is an enormous percentage. And it's sad because you only have one life unless you believe in reincarnation. So what I try to do is, and maybe that's the reason I deal with so many CEOs, because of the influence they have in the organization, is to create more reflective leaders. So some people get into conflict all the time. Some people thrive in conflict. But they also should do cost-benefit analysis, what they get out of it. So I try to make people more reflective. That is not just... I always ask, tell people, what do you want in life? You want to jump or you want to fall? Jumping, you have some control over the matter. And on some people, whatever darker side they have, to talk about their shadow side, to quote Jung, they don't want to look at it. They put it in boxes. And I try to help them open the box so they have more control of what's in the box. The other thing, of course, is that what I have tried to do in my work is to build more effective teams. I mean, it always surprises me that people spend tens of millions of dollars or more than that on IT and other things, but their top executive teams are not aligned, which cost enormous amount of money. I see it all the time. So I always say, give me... And so I have been the person at probably one of the... it sounds very narcissistic, which maybe it is, but probably the world leaders in team coaching. I mean, I have trained so many people in team coaching. So give me a somewhat neurotic team and I make something out of it, not a psychotic team. The other thing, of course, is I want to create great places to work. I've introduced a strange word in the language called the Ozentizotic organization, which is basically a combination of two Greek words, Ozentikos and Zotikos. But basically, people, organizations, places of work where people feel alive. And to me, the acid test is when people ask, when people want their children, they want their friends to work in the company. That's very rare.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's a very good, two very good questions. Yeah.
And then, of course, coming back to your comment about, happiness and things like that. I wrote actually a small book once on happiness. It has to do to help executives to have a more fulfilling life. And I wrote actually... recently, I mean, during the pandemic, I was waiting for a book. It was a more important book of mine called The CEO Whisperer, called Quo Vadis. And it's not an original title. It was used by Jesus already, or St. Peter, to go back, but also a Polish Nobel Prize winner. But basically, A Man in Search of Meaning, to you quote Viktor Frankl. And of course, I have some models in my mind, but what people tell me is that I have a capacity to take complex clinical concepts and translate it to make it understandable for the general reader, which is probably a result that I for a while had a column in a newspaper. I wrote a regular column. So when you write for a million people or whatever it might be, you cannot make too much gobbledygook or psychobabble. So... So he developed some kind of model of meaning, and I don't know if you. I can talk about it. I mean, so basically, in the book Quo Vadis is a small book. I wrote it in a month as a reaction to waiting for my brilliant editor, who is probably very slow. She's very slow, and she had been my editor for so many years, but she's very slow. So, and I'm quite an impatient person, to be very frank. But what I say there is that meaning is in the center of a number of balloons, what you might call it, whatever. And it has to do with a sense of purpose, So looking at the future, what you like to do, you know, what you, so it's a future, meaning is not the same as purpose. Purpose is future oriented. It has to do with sense of competence. What are you really good at? You know, do you have, are you a Mozart? You know, you have a talent in music or whatever. And might not even be a Mozart, there are a few Mozarts around, but still, what do you really, what gives you a sense when you do it, a sense of flow, to use that word used by this man from Chicago with an unpronounceable name,
Hungarian
name. And so it's what the sense of competence. Then, of course, what's incredibly important, that you quoted the Harvard longitudinal study, which I've so many always used in my work, where I used the book of Robert White, Life's in Progress, a sense of belonging. You know, it's really when you talk to those people who are still alive, or very few alive now, because the study started in 1938, when they were sophomores, you know, to having good relationship with family and friends is critical for your life. And then you have also the sense of control. Before the pandemic, I hadn't been back in my old university, the University of Amsterdam. That was my first university. And I must say, at the time, it was not glorious, my education. I didn't go often to university. I had better things to do than going to cafes and looking at people pass by, whatever it might be, and doing sometimes an exam, probably more like the German tradition in those days, that you didn't, you know, why go to university? But I wrote a note. I said, I've not been back there. Maybe I should give a speech. I never volunteer really for speeches. People usually ask me. I guess I get too many requests for that. And I wrote to the rector magnificus, which is the president of the university, and said, "Dear Miss So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, I would like to come back to the university and give a lecture." And she said, "Hi, Manfred, I was your student," which is, you know, shame on me. And I remember people's first name much better than the last name. And then she said, "And the dean of the faculty of economics, also your student." So I had no difficulty to give a talk. So there was a, you know, full audience. And I was thinking about it, about my cohort. Many of them are dead, and many of them had made terrible choices. And I said, if we would have had in this economic faculty, like in the other faculty, maybe psychology 101. And it has to do with coming back to my comment about my model, choice. What are the most important choices for the MBAs, or for anybody? Which is number one, a choice of partner. And as you know, we don't do a good job there. I mean, look at Christoph just mentioned, and always not always the best choices. And the second one is the choice of career. And again, why do people do the MBA program? Because they already got burnt in their previous job and decide, you know, I want to do something else. So the sense of control. And then I added to this particular diagram also the sense of transcendence. Because we work for money, maybe, but we die for a cause. And there is such thing as a cooperative motive. We're trying to do something for others. And actually, it makes you feel good. I mean, giving is better than taking, even though the takers seem to get look like they get more out of it. So a sense of transcendence is to go beyond your personal needs and say, what can I also do for others? And so when you have this model of sense of purpose, sense of competence, sense of belonging, sense of control, and sense of transcendence, there in the middle floats meaning. And that's that's really when I come back to my CEO, not the title for the program, by the way, it's called The Challenge of Leadership, Developing Your Emotional Intelligence. But in my CEO recycling seminar, in the end, that's what people really talk about, which has to do with the relationship with their partners, their children, their friends, and also how satisfied they are at work. And since we live longer, because the people who come to this program are usually at midlife, so many of them have an existential crisis. You know, we will have more of a portfolio career. It's going to be more common. We just live longer. And so that's the reason I felt it was rather useful to put it all together. And that's the reason I wrote a little book.
Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work. Hier kommt ein Werbepartner, den ihr aus der Vergangenheit schon kennt, weil wir schon eine Weile mit dem Unternehmen zusammenarbeiten. Es geht um Dell Technologies. Ganz konkret geht es um die Dell Technologies Expertinnen. Die findet ihr unter dell.de/KMU-Beratung. Wenn ihr anrufen wollt, falls ihr gerade im Auto sitzt, dann auch unter 0800 724 4869. Montag bis Freitag zwischen 8.30 Uhr und 17.30 Uhr. Jetzt aber einmal, worum es hier konkret geht. Mit Dell Technologies habt ihr die Möglichkeit, IT-Technologielösungen für Verbraucher und Unternehmen aller Größen speziell auf eure Bedürfnisse zugeschnitten zu bekommen. Das können Notebooks sein, PCs, Zubehör wie leistungsstarke Workstations bis hin zu Server, Storage, Cloud-Lösungen und Services. Mit den Dell-Finanzierungslösungen wiederum habt ihr die Chance, Dell Technologies so einzusetzen, dass ihr es implementieren könnt und trotzdem mit eurem Business möglichst alle Herausforderungen der aktuellen Lage zu meistern, eben alles aufrechtzuerhalten. Das heißt, ihr könnt IT implementieren, Dell Technologies jetzt nutzen und später zahlen. On top habt ihr noch den Pro Support Plus mit einem Support Assist, der Fehler erkennt, bevor sie zu Problemen werden. Und damit auch einen direkten Zugang zu Pro-Support-Technikerinnen und Technikern, die rund um die Uhr erreichbar sind. Das ist gerade jetzt super wichtig, um eben den Arbeitstag aufrechtzuerhalten, wenn es mal Probleme gibt, damit dann eben auch schnell repariert werden kann, zum Beispiel. Dell Technologies Expertinnen bieten euch als Unternehmen jeder Größe Technologielösungen an, die eben auf eure Budgets zugeschnitten sind. Das ist das, worum es geht. Und deswegen schaut unbedingt mal auf dell.de/kmu-beratung und sprecht mit den Dell Technologies Expertinnen und Experten online oder im Chat. Oder wenn ihr anrufen wollt, 0800 724 4869, Montag bis Freitag, 8.30 Uhr bis 17.30 Uhr. Sollte jetzt ein ganz guter Zeitpunkt sein. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Rest der Folge.
This is my question would have been, so our book will start with a chapter about self-reflection, because we believe it's the beginning. If you want to change anything, you have to reflect on yourself. What is the starting point? So this seems to be a very good model to start with yourself, to really self-reflect the situation. Is this what you do in the CEO seminar, that everyone really writes down into this bubbles where he is there or she is there? Is it the case?
People don't write things down in the bubble. I'm not that structured. Sorry about that.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's, Yeah, I've written in my life probably. I mean, when you talk about education in business schools, a lot of it is around case studies. And I must have written more than 100 case studies or something like that. And I've used it very actively, also visual case studies. I mean, video clips, video case studies. But in this program, because that's the reason I take only a few, and 21 people, it's the life case study. So, Michael, Christoph, you would be the case studies. And it's much more interesting to have the case study in class. But so everybody usually has an opportunity to be in quote-unquote hot seat. And, mm-hmm. and then they have to, coming back to your earlier question, to do a documentary in a way of your life. What are some, if you don't say anything, you don't get anything. So usually mm-hmm. people present some of their background to get the context of it and then talk about some of the things they're struggling with. And it is remarkable how much, of course, that's a good issue. You get, not just during the class time, but the behavior modification, if you use that term, starts actually at lunches, dinners, walking in the forest, talking with each other. So the program, it's kind of funny because I'm free associating as part of my program as a psychoanalyst. At INSEAD, anything you do, you get feedback. You have to get ratings. The problem with this program, I'm not being defensive in this respect, that some of the insights people have might take some time. So that's like when I was the head of the Global Leadership Center, I had this whole stable of coaches. And after every short intervention of 1 to 2 days, they were rated. But some of the comments they might have made only have impact, half a year later, said, my God, I realize now what's being said. So I try to create tipping points. That's the reason the program is very long. It's 4 iterations of a week, 3 2.5 months in between, and the last one 6 months later, when I want to see if people's good intentions, I start dieting, I start exercising, and, the New Year's, they come through. So, and sometimes you get disappointed. People fall back onto their normal pattern. But I try to push them a little bit. And people make important decisions in life, which can both in their public life and in their private life, which usually has to do with partner relationships. Many at midlife, many people discover at midlife they have been basically living side by side, parallel lives. It's not maybe the only thing that keeps them together is actually complaining about the children or whatever, you know, trying to deal with the children. But otherwise, there's nothing. And that's what, so they make some important, also to do with their work. They might decide, is that what I want to do? Is that gives me gratification? So that's what I do. I give lots of lectures and sometimes some short programs. But if you really want to help people change, you know, you're very malleable when you're a child. But at our age, it's hard work to get the brain adjusted. You have to practice other ways of doing things. It takes time.
How long, from your experience, is it possible that we still change? You talked about midlife. I guess this is something in the 40s, something around it, I'm afraid. And how long are we able to really, really change still then? Especially when it comes to self-reflection.
You can change your whole life. And also life takes care of you because, you know, when you age, your body starts aging, you get lots of impressions. Also, the relationship with people change as you age. Now it's a question also how to... I had an alumni session some years ago, and it was actually in St. Petersburg of one of my classes. And I was asking what they got out of the program for one person. I was talking to an Indian student of mine. And he said, you know, what I liked about the program was it brought me back to the time I was in college, that when everything was possible, which was an interesting... Mm.
That's a compliment, yeah. Wow. In one of your books, or maybe it was mentioned in more books, you are describing different archetypes of managers and leaders. Is it part of this program as well that they find out what kind of archetype they are, or is this a totally different approach?
I've done so much on... When I was the director of the Global Leadership Center, I had to help my coaches because coaching, as I said before, is not mass production. So you have small groups of usually 5 to 6 people and they have maybe 1 to 2 days. And so that adds up. And so they needed some material to work with. And to help them, I had to develop, you know, people can tell you that they're God's gift to humankind and they turn out to be Genghis Khan, whatever it might be. I sometimes say, you know, it's a saying, when one person says you have ears like a donkey, ignore it. But if 2 people tell you so, get yourself a saddle. So I had to develop a number of questionnaires. One is the Global Executive Leadership Mirror, Global Leadership Inventory, and also the Archetype Questionnaire, to help the people to get some insight about they're perceived by other people. And there was one questionnaire, the Leadership Archetype Questionnaire, which talks about the different roles people play in organizations, from strategist, deal maker, coach, communicator, transactor, meaning having the trains run, you can help the trains run on time, whatever it might be. So, if you take a team of executives, you can see what functions are not being taken care of. So it helps, again, to get some insight about their functioning. And, of course, if you are a great strategist and deal maker, you mightn't be the best coach. But at least you should be aware of it and maybe put somebody in the team, because leadership is a team sport. I mean, that's one of the problems, I think, very often with compensation system, that these are so exaggerated on the top. Like nobody else in the organization isn't doing anything. So that's the reason I keep on stressing that the team element. And so to look at the various roles people play, I wrote an article for the Harvard Business Review about this particular, the team approach and the different roles people play.
What I learned in your articles and book is that the time of superheroes is over. And at least this is how you wrote it. And you believe, and we stress this a little bit, but I would love to dive deep into it. You believe that good teams are important. I think the archetype model is one tool to create good teams, but there is probably much, much more to create a good team. What is your recipe to form good teams?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because when I was trying to tell the coaches I was training what I do, you know, many things I do experiential. So finally, in desperation, That's my, you know, again, how poor I am in explaining. I wrote a script. I hired 4 actors and to act out the script, because I could never film a real executive team in action. They would not allow that. That's a rarity that they would. And try to show how I work. And it's a mixture of, you know, first, of course, I want to have some information about them because I don't want to be fooled. As I said before, I've had too many situations before I developed all those instrumentation, and I'm not a, I mean, I'm not a, I became a psychometrician reluctantly, eh? But I had no choice because of somebody had to do it. So I collect lots of information about from people, so, and they get what I call a 720, not a 360. 360 is usually, you know, information you get from your subordinates, from your boss, from your colleagues and things like that. But I also collect information from you close people, you know, wife, husband, children, friends and things like that. So you get quite a portrait of it. And that's the first step. So people get this package with the feedback, and some of them get a great narcissistic injury because they thought they were glorious and turn out they are not so good. That's a real problem. But you know, I started to experiment with that particular model with the directors of McKinsey. And they are very good in reading figures and looking at graphs. That's no problem. So that's what, just looking at the graphs, they know they're not very good in. They're not very good in that. They're not good in team building. They have no vision. Some have no vision. Some cannot delegate, whatever. They don't empower, whatever it might be. Fine. But it is more interesting. I asked them, can you tell something about yourself? What are some of the critical moments in your life? How can it be that somebody from Cyprus ends up in New York as a partner or as a director? And so people tell stories. We have a natural tendency as storytellers. We did it from Paleolithic times. We told stories at fires. And so people like that. And then is the time I have to create an atmosphere where people are ready to play. And I try to illustrate that in, actually somebody must have put my video on online, so you can actually look at it. It's an intervention about an executive team of 4 people and how I work, which is a little bit, what I find sometimes very useful is to, if you asked, if Michael would be an animal, what animal would he be? Would he be an eagle? Would he be a dog? And what kind of dog? Would he be a German Shepherd or a Chihuahua? What would he be? And so people start to fantasize. In the meantime, Michael has to keep his mouth shut while they're talking about you.
Very difficult.
Which is not always easy. But it's slowly things also come out. And then I think it's important when you build a team to ask as a friend, knowing what you know now, you have seen some of the information given, you have heard the playfulness about this kind of, what could you tell him as a friend? If he would become, what would make him become more effective? And so people end up in this kind of interface as a team, with actually making contact between each other and also understand each other better. So you start to build, which is a very, you create more safety and more trust. And that will be critical, particularly when you talk about virtual teams, and it will be critical in the new world of work. Because, and McKinsey was a good example, because they quickly had to bring together one person from Frankfurt, one person from Chicago, one person from Delhi, and one person from Moscow to work together on a project. So, you know, you don't email a smile or a handshake. You have to make an investment, create some social capital beforehand. And so this is going to be even more important to create, to make an investment before the virtual team can really work. And that's actually a concern. I think I have some of my clients have a concern about it. Now that the pandemic is in some countries fading out, what to do about getting people back into the office? And how to create meaningful experiences? How to create social capital, which usually is done after a meeting, being at the coffee shop, sitting together, having lunch together, chatting a little bit in the corridor, those kinds of things. So to bring people at the office just to use a look at their screen, at the computer screen, I mean, you can do it at home. Why sit and sit for hours in the traffic? And that's a real serious question, how to mix it. So it puts an additional burden on senior executives to create, when you come to the office, And it has to be for meaningful experiences. And the office is not the same anymore. It's a different, it's a gathering place for social networking, for creativity and things like that.
Und in dieser ganz kurzen Werbeunterbrechung geht es um das Unternehmen Lab Campus. Das Ganze findet ihr auf der Website labcampus.de mit L-A-B geschrieben und Campus mit C. Dort findet ihr alle Informationen. Lab Campus ist der neue Innovationscampus direkt am Flughafen München. Die Idee ist, dass die Community, die dort arbeitet, ihr könnt dort nämlich Büros anmieten, sehr aktiv zusammenarbeitet, branchenübergreifend, dann auch Ideen entwickelt, die ganzen testet und zur Marktreife bringt, weil ihr habt die Möglichkeit, die Testingflächen am Airport zu nutzen, Feedback von Passagieren einzuholen und eben euren Mitarbeiterinnen und Mitarbeitern die flexiblen Arbeitswelten und die Freizeitangebote dort vor Ort auch zu bieten. Los geht das Ganze ab März 2022 und könnt dort eben jetzt eure Bürofläche mieten und vor allem individuell einrichten. Lab Campus, vielleicht nochmal so zum Hintergrund, möchte eben gemeinsam mit der Community an Lösungen der Zukunft arbeiten. Und ihr habt dort Unterstützung von den Innovationsservices, von den Community Services und habt eben auch ein internationales Partnernetzwerk dort. Also schaut mal auf die Website, ich habe es mir gerade angeschaut. Wir haben ja selber mit Blackboard in Berlin auch eine Fläche in einem Campus. Und hier in München am Lab Campus habt ihr jetzt die Möglichkeit, ähnlich zu arbeiten. Ich kann das auch nur gutheißen, weil das ist sinnvoll genutzte Fläche plus diese Vernetzung untereinander, die macht total Sinn. Die Vermietung beginnt sofort, also ihr könnt das anmieten und könnt ab März 2022 dort rein. Die Landingpage ist labcampus.de, L-A-B, Campus mit C.
It's fascinating to follow your explanation. So you said you test a little or lots of things, and I remember one of our podcast guests. Her name is Amy Edmondson from Harvard Business School. She's
a
team.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. And she found out that psychology safety is one of the or is the most critical success factor. And I think how you described it to build up social capital is the way to create this kind of atmosphere. So yeah, it fits together perfectly. Thank you.
The safety one, of course, she got quite... I think what's more important that you have... trust is the most critical commodity in an organization. If you don't trust each other, when you don't trust senior management, you don't feel safe. So trust is the basic commodity, I think. And, you know, organizations are not democratic institutions, which is very paradoxical. They're actually quite autocratic. And so how to create this paradoxical situation where people feel they can make an impact, they feel they have voice. And that's a very delicate thing, because at times of stress, you know, particularly, you know, leaders get impatient, they cannot do too much consensus management, but still, you have to pick up people's brain. If they don't feel involved, you get again the sense of being disengaged, when you come back, which I mentioned earlier, which is a major factor in organizations. And people don't give their best. You lose so much, you know, intellectual capital.
Yeah.
Investing, like social investment, as you said, this is something it feels like very natural. So this relates to my question of how easy can we change? Because what I see is that people want to go back to the offices. And of course, a lot of companies are asking, how does the office of the future look like? And the easy answer is bringing people back, like having more interaction and so on. But what you said between the lines, having the social investment is something totally different. Is it really related to a certain place, or what would be your take on what is coming up in the next years from the experience we just made?
No, I mean, I think the office is not going to be the same. I mean, I had always a great difficulty with these open offices, maybe myself, my own personal, and also with cubicles. And as you know, the cubicles get smaller and smaller, and even the open offices got smaller and smaller. And so, there is no sense of privacy. There's a sense of, and we already, I mean, organizations are very quick. Organization, I'm talking about the people in the organizations, of course, to start with paranoid and depressive thinking. So one has to find so organizations, as I said before, have to be social gathering points where people can can deal with their social needs. We all have social needs. That's also, by the way, coming back to personality, some people are very well off by themselves. They're quite introvert. They can do very well. Other people need a lot of external stimuli. So again, you have to tailor it a little bit. I've been here on my mountain in the south of France, and I guess maybe because of my particular personality makeup, I get lots of ideas all the time by reading, whatever I do. I don't need so much. I remember once a client I had who dragged his executive team a few times a week to nightclubs and restaurants because he had needed stimuli. That was important to him. So it really depends also that people's need for belonging, for need for external stimuli is different. But still, you need to create whatever, depending also on the industry, what industry you work. But if you talk about white-collar workers, you need to be extremely selective in the future about the reasons people are going to be in the office. Apple, I think, is a three-day in the office, 2 days off. It can be the other way around. But I just had a conversation with a senior executive about his concern about the executive team, because they only meet virtually. I've been meeting virtually for a long time, and he feels that it doesn't get the best out of the group. So it means that the CEO may have to use some, in spite of probably some pushback, some force to get the people for certain important meetings in the office, and also make it something more than maybe just and not just having a task-oriented discussion, but also a process-oriented discussion. I remember a South African company, very logistically oriented, and they made it a habit after every meeting to discuss how do you feel the meeting was? Mm-hmm. Could you have done it better? To have some process comments, and that's important. Not just saying, okay, we have a task to do and this is it, but also afterwards to spend some time on the meeting process and discuss it. And what could we have done to make it better? I think those things are going to be more important.
I would love, or we would love to talk a little bit about corporate culture. There are two aspects. There's this aspect of creating or keeping alive a culture in hybrid or in remote times. And the other aspect is we read an article about when a corporate culture can become too cultish. So I would discuss these two issues with you. Maybe we start with the difficulties to create culture during COVID times, and then we switch over to how can we avoid too cultish cultures.
I think when most companies have been basically taking advantage of the social capital they have built up before the pandemic. So they better be aware of starting to invest again. And I can particularly think about, companies, people come and go. And how do you socialize people virtually? With great difficulties, I can tell you that. How to really do that. Of course, you can say it's now easier. We can have lots of quick face-to-face meetings, particularly when you have a global company. But there is more to it. I mean, there is a lot of Zoom fatigue and whatever fatigue and Microsoft team fatigue or Google fatigue here on Google. So and particularly newcomers, to really get a sense of the do's and the don'ts. On the other hand, as I was trying to say in that article, which I think is part of my book, The CEO Whisperer, it's a delicate dance between too strong a culture and too weak a culture. And I think about IBM at one point in time, it was totally inward looking. And it was an outsider had to come to make the elephant dance. There was a book by that name. It was the new CEO coming in. And there was such strong... I remember once I gave a lecture at IBM, and they gave me a book, a whole book of songs about Mr. Watson, who was the founder of IBM, which was, quite crazy. I mean, all these company songs and things like that. Nothing bad about cohesion. But if you want fast decisions, Christoph and Michael, have clones. If you want creative decisions, which takes longer, have diversity. And that's what I do in my CEO seminar. I make an enormous effort. I mean, like the last class, 21 people, 60 nationalities, among others. Gender parity, which is very difficult for senior executives. and others in industry, different industry, to really get them, and family business, entrepreneurial, to very large corporations. So to really get a mixture of people, and then public organizations like universities and hospitals, which are the most difficult organizations because of the narcissistic individuals running around there, and more private organizations. So the mixture. So I'm a great believer in diversity. It's difficult. So it's the CEO is the high priest of culture, and unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Too often they don't realize anymore that role, and they also now the chief social relations, social capital person to imbue the company with social capital. So they have important roles, and they sometimes don't realize it because too many CEOs might come from a very technical financial route and have not had enough understanding of human relations.
Hmm. What are good examples for CEOs that are good high priests of culture, that who are actually doing this dance, this delicate dance, as you said, in a good way? Examples where you can see, is there actually a blueprint for someone who does it, related, of course, to the culture or the company or not?
Christoph, I'm very reluctant about blueprints.
I know, of course. I was aware of that, but I still ask.
No, but I mean, I have discovered that the best thing to do is you can say something about the person when he or she is dead. Then you have full house.
That's okay.
Because, give us a dead one.
Because, no, I mean,
no matter who.
That, I mean, I remember one chairman of a bank in Australia. And the bank was in great difficulties because of some unethical behavior. And they basically fired, I think, the two first layers, or even the third layer too. There was a big firing taking place. And he had to build up a new culture. And that was his talent. He was not a strategist. He knew he needed some strategies, but he had a deep understanding, coming back as a leader, as coach, a deep understanding of the top to 100, to the 100 people, the first 100 people in the organization, to match them and to create a complementary relationships. So that was, I don't want to mention his name. And so I met a number of people, but most people, you know, they're always some shadow side, and they have not necessarily come to grips with the shadow side. I wrote a little article for the Harvard Business Review just when the pandemic started, from one of my students many years ago, and talk about tipping points. And he wrote me a note. He said, "Dear Manfred, most companies I know are in panic mode after with the pandemic. I'm not going to fire anybody. I'm not going to fire any of the suppliers. I have decided that the top executive team has to cut their salaries by 50%. And I'm giving the example, and we are now collecting money, etc., for all those masks and things like that. We were at that time very scared." And I felt he was a man who was talk about change again, Christoph, who was actually quite an anxious person. Mm. But he had the courage, and he wrote an article about courage, which people seem to like. But it's a real story. It's really the courage of saying this, I have to do something, I rise to the occasion, I'm scared what's happening, but I think this is the right thing to do.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. It's a very good example. Let's finish this section with your red flags. You mentioned some red flags that indicate when a corporate culture is becoming cultish. Can you name some of them?
I already mentioned IBM was a very good example. And it really needed a major shock to get out of that. Very good example. Look at Enron and look at their values. I mean, that's what always I see. I when people ask me to do some consulting or whatever, I go to their website and look at how they describe their values. And fantastic innovation, respect for people. It was total bullshit. Bullshit. It was hire and fire, rank and jank. That was the real situation. So you have to really read between the lines. That was the real culture. So it's very nice to put all those beautiful statements. They don't mean anything. But, what people say and what people do is often a big difference. What are the elephants in the room? Can you fail forward? Can you make a mistake? It's the blame culture. It's dependency culture you see in many family-run businesses. And entrepreneurial businesses where people are too much dependent on the CEO. I mean, I had recently, I had to give a talk to a country I'm not going to mention, somewhere in Asia, in which the company was one of the most successful companies, not the most successful company in this country. And I had to tell the CEO and the executive board that emotional intelligence is important. How do you describe something so esoteric as emotional intelligence? And the only reason that emotional intelligence became aware of it, because the company was full of slogans, work harder. And, you know, it was basically what you can call a Frederick Taylor, you know, of the man of the time in motion study of the 19th century. He had all those, you know, more productivity and things like that. The only reason was that he was so productive that many of his laborers were put into some kind of dormitories and he got COVID. And so that came out that the work conditions were not very good. And so certain countries decided not to permit import of the products. That was the only reason. Otherwise, he would have gone his merry way. But it was very cultish and people were basically... So it was very difficult for me over Zoom to give a lecture or lecture, to have a discussion with very bad cameras and very bad sound. I remember that he should have been more obsessional about it, to try to explain a little bit about the importance of emotional intelligence and that he could even get more out of his people, because that was what counted, productivity.
Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work und unser Werbepartner diese Woche ist HubSpot. Kennt ihr schon als Tool, hatten wir schon mal da. HubSpot ist eine CRM-Plattform für skalierende Unternehmen. Also völlig egal, ob ihr 2, 20 oder 2000 seid, ist HubSpot eine Plattform, die ihr nutzt und nutzen könnt, im Einsatz habt. Und ganz konkret geht's hier um HubSpots Podcast The Digital Helpdesk. Da bekommt ihr Hands-on-Tipps zum Thema CRM, Marketing, Vertrieb, Kundenservice, aber auch zu Themen wie Leadership-Kultur, Diversität im Marketing. Das ist tatsächlich ein Trend, diese sehr spitzen, klaren Podcasts, den Gäste von uns auch schon mal prognostiziert haben vor einigen Jahren. Und das passiert hier jetzt gerade. Und mit den Hostinnen Jenny Lapp, Marvin Hinze, Ben Harmanus habt ihr die Möglichkeit, jeden Dienstag ein Interview zu bekommen zu diesen Themen. Neuerdings jeden Donnerstag eine kurze Episode Digital Helpdesk Shorts, bei denen ein Thema in unter 10 Minuten erklärt wird. Dann schaut einfach mal überall da, wo es Podcasts gibt, findet ihr HubSpots Podcast, der heißt The Digital Helpdesk. Jetzt viel Spaß mit dem Rest der Folge.
We all will have to learn much more in future that we might have had to learn in our recent years. And you are talking about learning organizations, learning culture as well. So what do you think are the things we have to learn for surviving the future?
Michael, when your mind is a hammer, you only see nails. So who am I? I'm a person who decided to make a shift from a more management structural point of view as an economist, and originally being an economist, to a more clinical point of view, a psychodynamic systemic point of view. So I have a bias. That's what I'm trying to say. And I'm trying to... Do you know the kind of the Plato's allegory of the cave? Do you know that story, allegory of the cave?
But tell it. It's interesting, yeah.
Basically, it's a story by Plato of a group of prisoners tied up in a cave. They can only look forward. Behind them is a fire. And when people walk, you know, behind the fire, there's shadows, two-dimensional shadows, are projected on the wall. You know, this kind of shadow play. And also the sound is rather distorted. So at one point in time, one of the prisoners escapes. He gets out of the cave and sees suddenly a three-dimensional world of color. So he's really amazed, incredible. Then he decides to go, or she decides to go back into the cave. But how do you explain if you have been, your life has been always two-dimensional, three-dimensional? So I'm trying to help people to see, to help them see that there are more things than they really see, to have a better understanding. When people, I mean, one of the things is to learn how to listen. I mean, babbling all the time, but I mean, I spend a lot of time listening. And listening not only what people say, but also what they don't say and how they say it, what they're really saying. Coming back to the comment you made about psychological safety and trust. So that is one of the important things. And it's also a way that I think is one of the most difficult things for the people in my class, that CEO recycling seminar. They used to talk and use that people listen to them. And now suddenly there are 21 people in class, and I try to be fair. They cannot talk all at the same time. They're back in school. So they have to raise their hand and say, listen, my turn, whatever. And but the forced listening is very helpful. I mean, I have an anecdote. I've taught it a number of times. I had one student in my class. I mean, repetitive. I told it recently to someone else. When she was the chairperson of the board. And let's call her Maria. And if she opened her mouth, I knew she would never stop. And I want to be fair in the distribution of time. So I said to myself, I didn't say it out loud, please, Maria, shut up. But Maria was kept on talking. Fine. So the next module was 2.5 months later. And there was Maria again. And Maria didn't say a word, not a peep. So after class, after a few days, I got very worried. I took Maria aside and said, Maria, what happened to you? She said, you know what? In the last seminar, during the dinners, people mentioned to me, the other narcissist, by the way, mentioned to me that, you know, I talk a little bit too much. I should learn how to listen. And during the 2.5 months, I was listening more and I learned a lot. So I didn't do anything. The narcissist turned to narcissist to calm down. So because it's very hard to help narcissists to be less narcissistic, but I didn't have to do anything. It was done for me. So that is that's the reason I'm a great believer in group and team coaching, because it goes quicker. Mm-hmm. It goes quicker. Yes. I use a psychodynamic lens or clinical lens, and people, you know what? And again, what I also said about relationships: what's good at 20 might be good at 40. So if you had a special pattern of behavior when you was 15 years old, one important concept in psychoanalysis is transference, which was actually, I guess, Freud talking to Jung. No relationship is a new relationship. All relationships are colored by previous relationship. So if you had an autocratic father, and you always get into fights with your father, there's a good possibility when you meet someone who reminds you of your father, you go on automatic pilot. So, as a psychologist or a therapist, you can tell a person, because of your background, it's more very likely that you have those behavior patterns. And so because your mother bounced you on your head when you were 5 years old, you're now traumatized, whatever it might be. And the person might say, very interesting, but that's it. It's, of course, interesting information. But if you say, you behaved to me like I was your father, I looked like your older brother, I'm not your older brother. And so what I try to do is to become more reflective before they get into overdrive and start into a conflict, an argument or whatever, to say, what am I doing now? Is it worse the argument? Last time I did it, I got myself into trouble. Of course, you have to think very much on your feet because you don't have much time, but you become more aware of your behavior patterns. And that takes time. And slowly, as I said, Christoph talks about malleability, you have to practice different behavior patterns and you might discover it works better. You have a better result. I say always, when people apply to my program, I talk to all of them. I mean, now on FaceTime or whatever it might be. And said, if you come to my program to become a charismatic transformational leader, please go to a snake oil salesman. He might sell you a fantastic program. You would be a transformed person. But if you want to learn more about yourself, and as a result, start to react to situations in a different way, maybe in a more effective way, and as a result, become a better leader, create a better corporate culture, this might be the program for you. So, but it's, and some people are very, it also depends on the culture. Certain cultures have a very hard time to really talk about the issues. Like, for example, when you come to countries like Malaysia, very strong defense, they're more group-oriented. So it's more difficult.
It was the best answer I could expect for this question. Thank you so much, really.
What are the best things or the most important things you learned about yourself during your journey, like starting off in that course? Like, you are the teacher, but of course you have interaction in that group as well, or you're the coach. What are some moments where you say, like, this is something I wasn't aware of before or myself, but I learned it on that journey?
No, I mean, I've learned most things from my students, and usually when they ask questions, I cannot answer, because then I get frustrated and try to make sense of it afterwards. I wish I was faster, or very often. I wrote a little book which is not out yet. It's called Leading Wisely, and the book is really some of the lessons I learned from my students. And I think I mentioned, I mean, I'm not in between. I've written two other books afterwards, two other books, so my mind is kind of else. But one thing is about the importance of the golden rule. Treat others like you want to be treated yourself. I think it's a very important thing. And do that or not just to people who are maybe have a lot of power or things like that, but also people who are underdogs, anybody, every human being. Another thing in that, one lesson which I learned has to do with pick your fights. Be careful about your fights. Ask yourself, it's a little bit like the famous Chinese general, ask yourself, what I'm doing now is still important a week from now, a month from now, a year from now. Also the element of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not forgetting. But if you don't forgive, as people have said, you poison yourself. It's a poison which keeps on hanging in there. And some people say when you cannot forgive, you have to dig two graves. One of the graves is for yourself. Also, that's another important factor in organizational life and life in general, is the whole issue of envy. Envy is part of the human condition, but keep it in balance. I mean, when you look at the seven deadly sins or whatever it is, envy was one of them, and keep it in balance. I mean, and all those sins, of course, gluttony and they're all, as I said, part of the human condition, the excesses of the human condition. Then also the element of courage. I mentioned courage. And then the element of, and Michael referred to that, the issue of happiness. Happiness is a very, a butterfly which jumps around. So, but try to create happy moments. And that's very important for your mental health. And I mentioned courage already. Some of the things. We live sometimes in acronyms, and I've created many acronyms, given that I've written so many books, because acronyms help you to remember certain things. And I sometimes talk about the 7C model of leadership, which is other than the leadership archetype model. And I think about that good leaders, they know how to deal with complexity, and organizations are highly complex things. They also are engaging in critical thinking. They don't take things for granted. They ask difficult questions. They know what they know, but they don't know what the other person knows, which means also the element of listening, of course. They have the courage. I mentioned it earlier. Also an element of self-confidence. And then you have things like compassion, care, and communication. Compassion is the ability to put yourself in other people's shoes. When I talk about empathy and compassion, I mean, there's some relationship between the two. But those are some of the elements which are important that you, in the most simplest form of leadership, and it was Fried Bales who started that about relationship orientation and task orientation. And how to combine those two things in a nuanced manner is very important, also depending on the people you deal with. If you are the managing director of McKinsey, and one of them was my student, you have a different leadership model than are you running a steel mill in the Caucasus. It was also one of my students. So they all say, leadership again, coming back, as I said earlier, leadership is a team sport. So you have to really think about the context where you're operating in and relate to that. I mean, how, for example, if you are dean of INSEAD, how to manage this complex situation with all those herding cats, and particularly the most difficult cats to herd are the full professors with tenure. I mean, what can you do to them? How to encourage them? How to get the best out of them? How to stretch them? How to work on their pride? How to create, leaders? Napoleon once said, leaders are merchants of hope. They have to speak to the collective imagination of their people to create a group identity. And that's what you have to do. You have to really engage them that way. But as I said before, and that is one extra, the leader now becomes the chief social relations manager. It's not just HR. It's him or her who has to do it.
Wow. Big words. Thank you, Christoph, for this question at the end of our podcast. We just have two small questions, how we like to close. I mean, you told me before we started the podcast that you wrote seven books during pandemic and more than 50 books in your whole career. And Christoph and I love to talk about inspiration, how people like you, how did you get your inspiration? Maybe you can name us three books you read from other people who inspired you.
No, I mean, it's of course, I'm as a psychoanalyst, I had to read the collective work of Freud. It's interesting. When you look at management books, with Amazon, you find very few bookstores. That's the sad thing about it. But when you go to the bookstores, big bookstores, there is lots of books on management, and there's an enormous turnover. The books on psychology are more stable. There's less of a turnover. So I'm quite impressed by books of course, Freud had to read and Jung. That has been very much important to me to help me to get some sense, even though some of their ideas are completely dated, but they have been very important to me. And nowadays, mm-hmm. probably I look at lots of movies. That also is quite, although I'm not a YouTube, I once had to do a TED talk. I remember that. I mean, a total nightmare because I got 17 minutes. 17 minutes. And usually when I give lectures, I do it much longer. But as I told you, Michael, writing, I followed Sir Bernard Shaw, who almost became a banker, I think. And he wanted to become a writer. And he decided, if I don't write, whatever garbage I write, I will not write. So I have learned, I write every day if I'm not traveling or teaching or so, I write some garbage. And eventually the garbage adds up. I was talking to a lady this morning. She said, I would love to write a book on this topic. I said, no, don't write a book. Don't write a book. Don't bother about it. Write some of your thoughts about the topic and write every day 500 words. You'll be surprised what happens to you. And then suddenly it's a book. That's what I do. So I get a crazy idea. One of my last book has something about white-collar criminals, about shame, about all different topics. Because I got about the seven deadly sins and the pandemic. Now I'm writing an article. I wrote an article about somatic symptom disorder because I met someone who has that problem. I've written about psychopathy in organizations. I mean, it just comes.
Very clever idea. Christoph, when we start our next project, we don't write a book, we just write every day.
So some garbage.
I think it's, yeah, really? Some garbage. Yeah.
There was some garbage in the day.
Mm-hmm. Find so I think in all this garbage, Christoph, there will be a horsey somewhere. You have this big pile of shit. You made the story about the little boy who got for Christmas a big pile of shit, and he saw a big smile on his face and start to dig in the shit. And people ask him, why are you so smiling? He said, there's all this shit, there must be a horsey somewhere.
I actually am taking notes and like making little icons, and I just painted a little pile of shit. So write some garbage every day. I love that. I definitely can relate to that. And we have to admit, Michael, the last question are actually three quick questions. So shoot it out.
You do it. This time it's you.
It's the bucket list question. It's on our list, Manfred. And we always want to know what you want to still learn, what you want to experience, and what you want to give back. These are the three things.
I'm trying to give back. That's what during the pandemic, I've done so many podcasts, conferences, and things like that. As I said before, I was struck by the comment by Margaret Mead, who is a famous anthropologist. She mm-hmm. said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So my fantasy always has been, when I can influence some executives, I said earlier, maybe it has an impact on society. What worries me, of course, one of my last books which just came out, which I haven't seen yet, I only have seen it as a PDF file. It's somewhere in Paris. It's called Leadership Unhinged. And there I make an enormous amount of noise about two leaders who irritated the hell out of me, which is, of course, Trump, who has been a character disorder, who became the president, the most powerful person in the world, and the other one is Bolsonaro. And particularly during the pandemic, because of their crazy behavior, which is so, you know, basically a malignant narcissistic behavior, which is the worst form of narcissism, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have died. And I have become, I made a transition from being an economist to be a management professor, to be a psychoanalyst, to be, of course, I've also always been a consultant, a coach, a trainer of coaches. And lately, I think I've made the transition more to a business philosopher. That because the kind of things I write are more of a general and more of a political nature about group behavior and things like that. While how do these people are able to seduce such a large part of the population? How dangerous it is for society? So that's things I want to do. I mean, I like culture. I like the outdoors. There was an article about me in March about lunch with the FT, in which I didn't get a complete opportunity to talk about my interest in nature. So that's very important. I've written some articles about ecotherapy, and I probably should, that the importance of green. And also, it has to do with the urban-rural divide. We were a rural society, and now we have gone to an urban society. And I wonder how good is this for people's mental health. So those are some of the questions I struggle with. And of course, I was just this weekend in Florence and Lucca and other cities. So that when you look at this cultural, it's always nice to see after such a long time being locked up. It's very nice. You realize how rich Europe is. And I'm going to Salzburg very soon to the belated Osterfestspielen. So belated. Very much belated.
Which relates back to the beginning, as you said, that's what you exactly missed about Europe coming back.
Although, I mean, don't underestimate from ecotherapy, where do you find, when you're in the center of Montreal and you drive an hour and you have bears, wolves, etc. around you and moose around you. So there is something to be said about that too. And go fishing, which is fantastic, all those lakes. So that's, it's a delicate, but of course here, I'm here on top of a mountain. I'm surrounded by wild boar. And I walk 10 minutes and I can the best shops to buy food. So it's a paradox.
I think the last thing is just, is there something you still want to learn? Some last thing? Because there is stuff, as you mentioned, that relates to that already. But is there something specific other than that, what you just mentioned?
It's, you know, it's an interesting thing about why do people pick careers they do? And an element of serendipity is there always. Like I was saying, that, you know, I saw this documentary about Madoff and start to think about white collar criminals and why do they do it and what is the cost of it, and start to think about it more in depth. I was looking at a book about Botticelli, who was the illustrator of the Divina Commedia of Dante. I was just in Dante's house actually this weekend. And so I got this idea. So when you look at the various capital sins, how are they affected by the pandemic? So those things happen. It's somewhat serendipity. So Christopher, I can't answer it completely. I don't have a master plan. It happens because of, you know, like the talk we have now. I will start to think about that and reflect on certain things, and gives me new ideas. That's the reason I'm doing it.
And that's just a perfect answer.
Yeah.
To answer that question. It's no better imagination for an ending like this, because this is exactly what we were hoping for, a conversation, as Michael said, on a kitchen table that leaves enough room to reflect on later on and maybe find something for ourselves.
Yeah, Manfred, it's really, I have to say, Christoph typically is our timekeeper, and at minute 55 he says, well, we will hit the hour very soon. We're now at 1:10, and I could follow this for many more hours. I'm so thankful. I'm really relaxed. I think my pulse was getting down 10 beats per minute since we started to talk.
I'm a tranquilizer. That's terrible.
No, it's not tranquilizing. It's really such a big gift for us and our listeners. And I really just want to thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
I'd like to thank both of you because your questions, you know, it takes 2 to tango, or 3 to tango in this case. Otherwise, it won't work.
Thank you so much,
Matt. I once had a conference, actually, and the person didn't realize it. I was looking during an hour and a half at the back of his hair. He didn't know it. And I didn't want to say it because I was on, it was live. And I mean, it's certainly not very inspirational. So thank you for the very interesting questions.
Thank you so much, Manfred. Really a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yes, well, two sides of comments. I was quiet because I was listening really from the first second on with so many people, in quotes, organizations where people feel alive, helping executives to live a more fulfilling life, talking about purpose, meaning, the choice of partner, of career. And I would say I didn't make a wrong choice of partner. I would say I made the choice that helped me learning, but still, it's an important choice. Same for the partner. Social investment. So much in this one thing. And thank you, Michael, for pushing this into the book. And I want from you just the answer to the question, can we actually do something about the date of this podcast? Because it's, I saw it where you want to put it, and it's just too late. It needs to be out there faster.
Okay. Let's discuss this later. I really want to thank you again for your last big question, because he gave such a nice summary of what he learned. And I think this could become a new section that we ask our people, what did you learn from others over your career? And this as one of the last questions. I really, really loved the answer, and it really... yeah, it really summed it up. And yeah, thank you, Christoph. I think it was the best question ever made in our podcast, and it was one of the best answers we ever get.
Wow, thank you.